welcome to the reading of the Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, November 30th. And this is Peter at IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Services for the Blind and the Disabled. And today we are going to read the Telegraph Herald. And let's see what's going on here. First of all, we've got schools balance student privacy, promotion on social media. Study shows an estimated 4.9 million posts that include identifiable images of students on public Facebook pages from 2005 to 2020. Photos of students dominate the websites and social media pages of area school districts, but maintaining student privacy while sharing school news is a balancing act, according to local officials and a new national study. U.S. schools and districts shared an estimated 4.9 million posts that include identifiable images of students on public Facebook pages from 2005 to 2020, according to a study published earlier this month. Around 726,000 of those posts are thought to identify one or more students by their first and last names. The study's authors contend that those photos likely are being viewed by a range of actors, including government agencies, predictive policing companies, and those with nefarious intent. And that districts and tech companies should take precautions to limit the spread of students' personal information. Officials with local school districts said student privacy is paramount in their efforts to share positive district happenings online, and staff continue to update their posting practices as online platforms evolve. This is my 17th year in the district, and it was a whole lot easier to monitor 17 years ago, said Jim Roberts, Director of Instructional Technology and Student Reporting for Western Dubuque Community School District. It's gotten harder and harder over the years because it's so much easier to share photos and information about students on places like Facebook or Twitter. We do take it very seriously. Permission and policies. According to Mike Sees, Chief Communication Office for Dubuque Community Schools, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act guides schools in sharing student photos and personal information. Under FERPA, that's F-E-R-P-A, schools can release certain information about students known as directory information that would not generally be considered harmful if shared. Directory information includes items such as students' names and photographs and grade levels, dates of attendance, awards received, and participation in officially recognized activities and sports. Parents have the option to not allow their students' directory information to be shared. Should we post anything that's outside of directory information, we would seek explicit parental consent, C says. For example, if the district wishes to highlight special education services and identify a particular student, they would ask parents before doing so. As a rule of thumb, most local districts opt not to identify students in posted photos except in special circumstances, such as when a student receives an award or achieves a notable accomplishment. Sees also notes that such information often already is being shared publicly by the awarding organization. Schools are one part of a much broader social media landscape, and we work to tell our story in that, he said. And in other news, area native named new director of Dubuque County Health Department, Allie White, will assume the role next month after 4 years as health services coordinator for Dubuque School District. The Dubuque County Board of Health has named a new county health department director after a year-long search. Allie White of Epworth, Iowa, will assume the role in mid-December and will have an annual salary of $100,000. She currently serves as health services coordinator for Dubuque Community Schools. She said that her first priorities in the new role include guiding the department through an upcoming strategic planning process. We'll be exploring options to promote and enhance opportunities for wellness for all age groups, White says. I'm excited to get started and serve the community in the best way that I can. White will be the department's first permanent director since longtime leader Patrice Lambert retired at the end of 2021. The department then was led in an interim capacity by Assistant Director Samantha Kloft until she left in August to pursue her doctorate in public health. Stacy Killian, Director of Unity Point Health Visiting Nurse Association, has served in the role on an interim basis since then. Developer plans Piasta Apartments. Callahan Construction intends to construct 5 16-unit buildings near Adrena Drive. In Piasta, Iowa, 80 new apartments are coming to Piasta as the developer considers further future projects. Callahan Construction plans to construct 5 16-unit apartment buildings near Adrena Drive along US 20. The project is located in the southwest corner of a plot of land the company plans to develop west of Cox Springs Road. Piasta is one of the fastest growing cities, said Joey Callahan, part owner of Callahan Construction and son of President Joel Callahan. It's always good to expand the housing market to alleviate upward pressures on housing costs. With Northeast Iowa Community College also there, we think it's a great chance to give students a place to live that's close by or anyone who wants to live and work in Piasta as well. Each of the five buildings will have 16 market-rate units, and each unit will have 2 bedrooms and 2 bathrooms. The timeline of the project depends on the weather. We're still moving dirt out there, Joey Callahan said. If the weather stays in our favor, we would try starting to build this year. If not, we would start work in the spring. Okay, let's look now at the Dubuque and Tri-State Area page. This is the news brief column. Former Dubuque County long-term care facility employee pleads guilty to assaulting resident. A former employee of a Dubuque County long-term county facility has pleaded guilty to assaulting a resident. Dante R. Bartman, age 21, of Dubuque, recently pleaded guilty in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County to a charge of dependent adult abuse with intentional physical injury. If a plea deal is accepted, a charge of assault with the injury would be dismissed. Plea documents state that both prosecutors and the defense are recommending a deferred judgment and 2 to 5 years of probation. With a deferred judgment, your probation and payment obligation are successfully completed. The record of the case is expunged. Court documents state that Bartman was an employee at Sunny Crest Manor, located at 2375 Roosevelt Street, when a fellow employee saw him assault a resident on March 2nd. Bartman was shaking the resident and saying, "Stop it, you better stop it." Document states, as a witness was leaving to get another staff member to assist with the incident, she heard a distinct skin-to-skin slap, document state. Staff members then removed Bartman from the area. Staff saw a red mark on the resident's cheek and neck area that they believe looked like a handprint. Bartman declined to give a statement when asked to speak with Sunnycrest staff and resigned, documents say, in the state. The warrant for Bartman's arrest was issued on May 24th. Bartman's sentencing hearing is set for Monday, December 5th at the Dubuque County Courthouse. And in other news, in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, authorities report cause of a crash that killed 2, injured 3 in Prairie du Chien. Authorities on Tuesday released more details about the cause of a head-on crash that killed 2 people and injured 3 others Sunday in the Prairie du Chien area. Witness reported that an eastbound SUV driven by Tracy Jo Larson, age 43, of Prairie du Chien, crossed the center line on US 18 between the bridges of Prairie du Chien and Marquette, Iowa, at about 11:20 a.m. and crashed head-on with a westbound truck driven by Luke Hackman, age 36, of Decorah, Iowa, according to the Crawford County Sheriff's Department. Larson and Hackman were killed in the wreck. Hackman's wife and 2 young children suffered non-life-threatening injuries, according to the release. The crash closed the highway for about 4.5 hours. The incident remains under investigation. Cast of Emmy-nominated improv comedy show to perform in Dubuque. Cast members of an Emmy-awarded improvisational comedy show will perform in Dubuque in May. the Who's Live Anyway tour features cast members of Whose Line Is It Anyway? And will perform on Wednesday, May 17th at Five Flags Theater, the venue announced on Tuesday. Cast members Greg Proops, Jeff B. Davis, Ryan Stiles, and Joel Murray perform the 90-minute touring show, which relies upon audience participation to generate improvised comedy. Tickets will be available beginning at 10 a.m. Thursday, December 1st at the Five Flags box office and at Ticketmaster.com. Holiday Market planned for Dubuque Millwork District. An outdoor holiday market will return this week in downtown Dubuque. A Merry Millwork Market will be held from 4 to 8 p.m. Friday from December 2nd and 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, the 3rd of December, on East 10th Street between Jackson and Washington Streets. The event includes a tree lighting ceremony in the Schmid Innovation Center courtyard at 6 p.m. Friday, as well as live music, horse and carriage rides, and visits from Santa himself. And police record. The Dubuque Police and Dubuque County Sheriff's Departments have the following reports. Jalen E. Dura, age 19, of 1091 Rockdale Road, number 10, was arrested at 10:31 p.m. on Monday at Unity Point Health Findlay Hospital at 350 North Grandview Avenue on charges of assault and public intoxication. Donald Briggs, age 39, of 2246 Jackson Street, was arrested at 12:11 p.m. Monday at her residence on charges of domestic assault, also interference with official acts, child endangerment, and two counts of assault on persons in certain occupations. Court documents state that she assaulted two Dubuque police officers during the course of her arrest. Items worth $634 were reported stolen from a person at about 12:05 p.m. Monday while at Walmart at 4200 Dodge Street. And other news in this column. Holiday train set to make three area Iowa stops next week. Canadian Pacific Railway's holiday train will visit three communities next week as it embarks on its first cross-continent tour in 3 years. The train, effectively a portable holiday concert decked out in bright flashing lights, rolls into communities to perform concerts and raise money and food and awareness for local food banks. Canadian Pacific held virtual concerts during the pandemic years of 2020 and 2021, according to a press release. On Tuesday, December 6th, the train will arrive in Bellevue, Iowa at about 6:45 p.m. with an event from 7 to 7:30 p.m. in the Horizon Lanes parking lot at the corner of Jefferson Avenue and Elizabeth Street. The train then travels north to Dubuque, where it will arrive at about 8:30 p.m. with an event from 8:45 to 9:15 at the Hawthorne Street Railroad crossing at the corner of Hawthorne Street and Romberg Avenue. Then on Wednesday, the 7th of December, the train arrives in Gutenberg, Iowa at about 12:45 p.m. for an event from 1 to 1:30 p.m. on the east side of the Schiller Street Railroad crossing. Performers at the Eastern Iowa stops will be Canadian musicians Alan Doyle and Kelly Prescott. Holiday train shows are free to attend. Canadian Pacific asks attendees to bring cash or a non-perishable food donation. All right, now let's turn to the other view. This is an opinion that is published by the Telegraph Herald, and it is called The Other View, and this is by Eric Friedenlund. And this article is an op-ed, and it's titled, We Can Still Believe in Science. I intend to be overly analytical. Given an intractable problem, I can ruminate on solutions until the cows come home. The farmer has usually gone to bed before I arrive with an answer. My analytic side comes from my interest in science. Reading about relativity and quantum mechanics leaves me scratching my head in amazement or befuddlement. Sometimes both. Our intuition finds little footing in theories based on complex mathematics. As three-dimensional creatures, we find it difficult to visualize the four-dimensional universe of space-time. Science gives us a window to look at the world, albeit rigorous in its interpretations. Scientific theory does not base its conclusions on public opinion, but relies on peer-reviewed evidence instead. We call this the scientific method. I'm reminded of the line by Tom Cruise in the movie A Few Good Men, looking to unearth the truth about Colonel Jessup's culpability in a crime. Cruise Lieutenant Caffey says, "It doesn't matter what I believe, it only matters what I can prove." A nation seemingly in love with conspiracy theories would do well to remember that line. The conundrum of what we believe and what we can prove gets messy when science runs up against philosophy and religion. Krzysztof Kapra, a world-renowned expert in systems thinking, draws parallels between Western science and Eastern religion in his book, The Tao of Physics. That's T-A-O. In his view, both science and religion suggest we are part of a system larger than ourselves. Science does not need mysticism, and mysticism does not need science, but man needs both, writes Capra. On the other hand, Sabine Hausenfelder, author of Existential Physics, takes a no-nonsense approach to the mixing of science and religion. Regarding theories that introduce unobservable parallel universes, she maintains that this isn't science, it's religion masquerading as science under the guise of mathematics. She's drawn the ire of other scientists and writers when she suggests that science precludes free will. She's been labeled the free will denier by science writer John Horgan. Yet, for all her controversy, she displays a refreshing sense of humility. I want scientists to be mindful of the limits of their discipline. Sometimes the only scientific answer can give is we just don't know. Yet, for all her controversy, she displays a refreshing sense of humility. I want scientists to be mindful of the limits of their discipline. Sometimes the only scientific answer we can give is we don't know. For those science deniers who believe this gives us permission not to believe in global warming and other controversial hypotheses, think again. Hausenfelder was referring to scientific theories outside the observable universe, such as what happened before the Big Bang. For those deductions within our observable universe, science works quite well. Thank you very much. We landed humans on the moon and robots on Mars with astonishing accuracy in quantum mechanics, despite their non-intuitive nature, have been proven time and time again through experiments. Your television brings you Sunday night football. Your car takes you to reliably to work. Your microwave cooks your mac and cheese, and you're reading this column on a digital or printed medium, all because of scientific method works. Science is intertwined with our everyday lives, which makes conditional believers out of all of us. While taking my daily hike in the woods, I came upon a mesmerizing sight, leaves gyrating around their stems like partners dancing in an Irish jig. I couldn't detect anyone to speak of, and the adjacent leaves were not moving. Nature was playing a trick on me, and I could not follow its sleight of hand. The analytic side of me wondered what could cause such a strange phenomenon. Googling the topic, I found that most likely explanation was an isolated current of air, not magic. Yet the curious side of me watched in awe. Science allows this. We can still find mystery in the world without abandoning our analytic side. We can still believe in science. And our columnist here, who lives in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, writes about nature and politics and social issues from a systems perspective. All right, let's move on to more of Tri-State News. Trial date set for man accused of fatal shooting. Kewanee D. Evans' trial is scheduled for July 11th. Evans has pleaded not guilty to multiple charges tied to the June 4th incident in Dubuque. A trial date has been set for a man charged with murder for a fatal Dubuque shooting. Kewanee D. Evans, age 31, of Freeport, Illinois, is charged in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County with first-degree murder, first-degree robbery, and possession of a firearm by a felon. He's pleaded not guilty on the charges, and his trial now is scheduled for July 11th at the Dubuque County Courthouse. The charges stem from the fatal shooting of Taiwan M. Jackson, Jr., age 20, of Dubuque. Court documents state that the police responded to 1900 block of Central Avenue at about 7 p.m. on June 4th. Jackson was found on the ground with multiple gunshot wounds, taken to Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center, where he was pronounced dead. Evans was attending a birthday party in that area with family members. Documents state that a witness reported he saw Evans come up behind Jackson Jr. and shoot him with a handgun in the back of the head, and then again in the face. Police obtained surveillance video, which shows that Evans shooting Jackson Jr. from behind him in the back of the head, documents state. Video also shows Evans shooting Jackson Jr. two more times while on the ground. The surveillance of video shows that Evans rolling Jackson over and taking an item out of his pocket, which a witness reported was a handgun, documents state. Evans was arrested around 12 hours after the shooting in the 2100 block of Holiday Drive. Police have said that Evans knew Jackson, but court documents do not indicate a motive for the shooting. Documents note that Evans is a convicted felon. Evans' attorneys Les Blair and Joey Hoover recently filed a motion to separate the charge of possession of a firearm by a felon from Evans' other two charges, meaning that Evans would be tried separately on the firearm possessions charge. Once the jury learns that Evans is prohibited from possessing firearms because he is a convicted felon, the jury will not be able to put that aside and judge allegations of murder and robbery that are completely independent both of the alleged firearm possessions and the prior offense that resulted in Evans being a convicted felon, the motion states. This will deprive Evans of an impartial trial that is guaranteed by constitutions of the United States and the state of Iowa. All right, now let's take a look at some news in brief. Listening session for women in agriculture to take place in Maquoketa. A listening session for women in agriculture will be held in Maquoketa next week. The Women, Land, and Legacy listening session will be held from 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday, December 8th at the Timber Center at 1005 East Platt Street with a meal to begin at 5:30 p.m. according to an online event announcement. The event is also co-hosted by U.S. Department of Agriculture, Natural Resources Conservation Service, and Farm Service Agency, as well as ISU Extension and Outreach. Delaware County Canine to receive donated protective vest in Manchester, Iowa. A local law enforcement agency, canine unit, will receive donated body armor. Delaware County Sheriff's Department dog Eclipse will receive a bullet and stab protective vest from the nonprofit organization Vested Interest in Canines. An online announcement states the vest is sponsored by Kimberly Shader of Orlando, Florida. Delivery is expected within 8 to 10 weeks. Vested Interest in Canine accepts tax-deductible contributions in any amount. A donation of $960 sponsors one vest. Camp Albrecht Acres to host breakfast event with Santa. In Sherrill, Iowa, Camp Albrecht Acres will host a fundraising breakfast this weekend featuring a visit from Santa. The Waffles with Santa event will be held from 7:30 a.m. to noon on Sunday, the 4th of December, at the facility at 14837 Sherrill Road. Breakfast will feature meat, applesauce, milk, juice, coffee, all-you-can-eat Belgian waffles, and the event will feature a visit from Santa and Mrs. Claus. The cost is $5 for children younger than 5 and $10 for all others, with proceeds supporting the 40-acre residential camp for people with disabilities. Financial Management Group opens second Southwest Wisconsin location. In Boscobel, Wisconsin, a financial management firm has opened a second location in Southwest Wisconsin. Rosemeyer Management Group recently opened a location in Boscobel, Wisconsin, at 310 Parker Street. The firm also has locations in Platteville, Wisconsin, and Dubuque, along with two other locations in Illinois and Wisconsin. The firm specializes in comprehensive wealth management for high net worth families and company-sponsored retirement plans for business owners. A new release states that the company decided to open the Boscobel location after noticing that residents of northern Grant County and neighboring Crawford County were driving long distances to find financial advisors. I'm excited to be able to bring to Boscobel and the surrounding areas comprehensive wealth management that I believe the area is lacking, financial advisor Peyton Simon, who will staff the Boscobel location, said. Too often I've met with people that simply were not able to access quality financing planning within our community. It's my goal to change all that. Organizers select theme for 2023 Cascade Hometown Days. In Cascade, Iowa, organizers have selected a theme for next summer's Cascade Hometown Days. Summer Beach Bash will be the theme for the 7th annual celebration held the 18th of August to the 20th. The free event features a parade, live music, and a variety of games and activities. The committee is hard at work lining up music, entertainment, kids' activities, and so much more. Hometown Day's social media manager Jordan Truman says, be thinking all things Jimmy Buffett, Hawaiian shirts, beach volleyball, and so much more. It's going to be one of the best, as the committee has been dreaming and wanting this as a theme since the start of the event. Southwest Tech receives $50,000 grant in Fenimore, Wisconsin. Southwest Wisconsin Technical College in Fenimore recently received a $50,000 to be put toward student enrichment opportunities. Compeer Financial made the donation as part of a larger $600,000 investment into community and technical colleges across its 144-county territory, according to a press release from Southwest Tech. The funds will go towards programming and materials for the college's mobile agricultural lab and support for its livestock judging teams. The mobile agriculture lab will make an on-site visits to area high schools and community events through the year to better inform the community about opportunities in agriculture. Well, here's my favorite part of my program, lifestyle, and it's all about food. And this particular little goodie is in the quick fix column. This is coconut crusted shrimp, bakes in only 10 minutes. Crispy coconut flavors these shrimp for a tasty, quick dinner. My husband wanted to have some coconut crusted shrimp, and I wanted to bake them rather than fry them. Mixing coconut and panko breadcrumbs with a little oil was the answer. The mixture coated the shrimp, and they baked in only 10 minutes. And, oh, by the way, this is written by Linda Grassenheimer. This is her recipe. One secret to make sure both sides are cooked without needing to turn the shrimp over is to place the baking tray in the oven while it preheats. The shrimp will cook on the bottom side this way. Now, here's some helpful hints. You can use any type of noodles for the sesame noodles recipe. You can press the coconut mixture into the shrimp to make sure that they're coated. Countdown. Preheat the oven to 400 degrees Fahrenheit. Place the foil-lined baking sheet in the oven while it preheats. Place a large saucepan filled with water on to boil for the noodles. Prepare the ingredients. Make the shrimp and bake. Boil the noodles and complete the dish. Shopping list. Okay, here's what you need for this. You need 3/4 of a pound of large shrimp, peeled and tail also off. 1 package of sweet coconut flakes, 1 container of panko breadcrumbs, 1 can vegetable of oil spray, 1 bottle of sesame oil, 1 jar of apricot jam, 1 small Dijon mustard, 1 small bottle hot pepper sauce, 1 package of egg noodles, 1 bunch of scallions, 1 container of cherry tomatoes, and 1 cucumber. And the staples are canola oil, salt, and black peppercorns. Okay, now here's how you make it. First, you have 1/4 sweetened coconut flakes, 2 tablespoons of panko breadcrumbs, 1 tablespoon of canola oil, 3/4 of a pound of large shrimp peeled, tail on, vegetable oil spray for dipping the sauce, 3 tablespoons of apricot jam, 1 tablespoon of Dijon mustard, several drops hot pepper sauce. So you preheat the oven to 400 degrees, line a baking sheet with foil, and place in oven while it preheats. Have the coconut flakes and panko breadcrumbs on a plate. Add the canola oil and blend into the crumb mixture to form a light paste. Place the shrimp on a large plate and spoon the crumb mixture on top of the shrimp. Press the crumb mixture into the shrimp with a spoon or your fingers. When the oven has reached 400 degrees, remove the baking sheet and spray with vegetable oil spray. Now, place the shrimp with the crumb mixture facing up on the sheet. Return the baking sheet to the oven and bake for 10 minutes. Then, turn the broiler on and broil the shrimp 20 to 30 seconds to crisp the shrimp. Watch to see that they don't burn. While the shrimp bakes, Mix the apricot jam, mustard, and hot pepper sauce together. Spoon into separate small bowls for dipping sauce. Divide the shrimp between the two dinner plates and add the dipping sauce. Okay, now the sesame noodles. You're going to need 4 ounces of egg noodles, 1/2 cup of sliced scallions, 1 cup of cherry tomatoes, 1 cup of cucumbers, 3 tablespoons of sesame oil, salt, and freshly ground black pepper to taste. Place a large saucepan filled with water onto boil. Add the noodles, boil rapidly for 6 minutes. Add the tomatoes and cucumber and continue to boil for 2 minutes. Remove 2 tablespoons cooking liquid to a large bowl and mix the sesame oil. Drain the noodles and vegetables and add them to the bowl. Mix well and add salt and pepper to taste. Serve with the shrimp. Yield 2 servings. Yum, yum. All right, now let's take a look at some other news here. Let's go to our obituary news here for the day. And I also want to remind you that you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services Network for the Blind and the Disabled. And I am your host and your reader, Peter Welch. And you are listening today on Wednesday, the 30th of November, to the reading of the Telegraph Herald. And we do have some obituary announcements here. Pamela K. Arzendorf, age 70, of Dubuque, passed away on the 27th of November at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin. Memorials may be directed to the family. The family wishes to thank the doctors and the staff at Mercy One Medical Center in Dubuque, Fire and EMS, and UW-Madison Hospital staff for the loving care and compassion given to Pam and to her family. Joseph C. Box, age 88, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, formerly of Dubuque, passed away on Sunday, the 27th of November. Funeral mass will be at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, on December 2nd at St. Joseph Catholic Church, Marion, Iowa. Visitation for 1 hour prior to the service at the church. Burial at a later date at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Dubuque. Paul Ekstrom of Dubuque has passed on November the 21st at the age of 97, following an enjoyable year at Oak Park Place, Dubuque. The Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena, Illinois, is assisting the family. Rose C. Oldenburg, age 99, of Galena, has passed away at her home surrounding by family. A massive Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, December 3rd, at St. Mary's Catholic Church, Galena, where friends may call after 10:30 a.m. until the time of Mass. Friends may call from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, the 2nd of December, at the Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena. A parish rosary will be recited at 3:30 p.m. at the funeral home. The burial will be in the church cemetery. Military honors will also be accorded graveside by Galena VFW Post number 2665 and American Legion Post number 193. Here's a small column that I like to read each time I read the Telegraph Herald. This columnist is Michael Rosen. And he has something interesting here. 40 or fewer grams of carbs a day can reverse prediabetes. Oprah struggled with a diagnosis of prediabetes and lost and gained weight off and on until she revamped her eating habits, fewer, healthier carbs, and established more realistic goals. Gone for me are the days of wanting to be thin, to fit into anything other than my best body and best life. Now, a new study reveals how the 96 million adults in the U.S. with prediabetes can stop their race to full-blown diabetes in 6 months without much stress or strain. That includes 70 million who are not aware that they have the condition, which increases the risk for heart disease and stroke. According to research published in JAMA, that's J-A-M-A Network, Open, sticking to a low carb diet, fewer than 40 grams of carbs daily, does the trick. The study compared 75 folks ages 40 to 70 who had an A1C of 6% to 6.9% and who went on the restricted diet to 75 folks with the same age and A1C levels who stuck to their normal eating routine. It showed that low-carbohydrate diet intervention groups had significantly greater six-month reductions in HbA1c. If you're overweight, do not exercise regularly, have a parent, brother, or sister with type 2 diabetes, or have PCOS, ask your doctor for a blood test to check for prediabetes. If you're diagnosed, you can hit the mark for 40 grams of carbs a day with a half a cup of cooked beans, 15 grams, half a large apple, 15 grams, one cup of blueberries, 9 grams, and 7 to 9 servings of non-starchy vegetables and fatty fish like salmon. All right, let's take a look at some other things going on here. In Washington this time, Senate passes same-sex marriage bill. Legislation moves to the U.S. House before heading to President Biden's desk. In Washington, the Senate passed bipartisan legislation Tuesday to protect same-sex marriages. The bill, which would ensure that same-sex and interracial marriages are enshrined in federal law, was approved 61-36 on Tuesday, including support from 12 Republicans. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said that the legislation was a long time coming and part of America's difficult but inexorable march towards greater equality. Democrats are moving quickly, while the party still holds the majority in both chambers of Congress to send the bill to the House and then, they hope, to President Joe Biden's desk. The bill gained steady momentum since the Supreme Court June decision that overturned the federal right to an abortion, a ruling that included a concurring opinion from Justice Clarence Thomas that suggested same-sex marriage could also come under threat. Bipartisan Senate negotiations got a kickstart this summer when 47 Republicans unexpectedly voted for a House bill and gave supporters to new optimism. The legislation would not force any state to allow same-sex couples to marry, but it would require states to recognize all marriages that were legal where they were performed and protect current same-sex unions. If the court's 2015 Obergefell versus Hodges decision were to be overturned, the bill would also protect interracial marriages by requiring states to recognize legal marriages regardless of sex, race, ethnicity, or national origin. Our community really needs a win. We have been through a lot, says Kelly Robinson, the incoming president of a human rights campaign which advocates on LGBTQ issues. As a queer person who's married, I feel a sense of relief right now. I know my family is safe. The vote was personal for many senators, too. Schumer said on Tuesday that he was wearing the tie he wore at his daughter's wedding, one of the happiest moments of my life. A decade ago, it would have strained all of our imaginations to envision both sides talking about protecting the rights of same-sex married couples. Passage came after the Senate rejected 3 Republican amendments to protect the rights of religious institutions and others to still oppose such marriages. Supporters of the legislature argued that these amendments were unnecessary because the bill had already been amended to clarify that it does not affect rights of private individuals or businesses that are currently enshrined in law. The bill would also make clear that a marriage is between two people, an effort to ward off far-right criticism that the legislation could endorse polygamy. Republican Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina, who has been lobbying his fellow GOP senators to support the legislation for months, pointed to numbers of religious groups supporting the bill, including the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Some of those groups were part of negotiations on the bipartisan amendment. They see this as a step toward for religious freedom, Tillis goes on to say. All right, what else is going on here? Well, you probably are aware that we're close to a railroad strike, and the damages that could be caused by that are almost incalculable. Anyway, this article is Railroad Unions Decry Biden's Plan. In Omaha, railroad unions on Tuesday decried President Joe Biden's call for Congress to intervene in their contract dispute, saying it undercuts their efforts to address workers' quality of life concerns. But businesses stressed that it's crucial to avoid a strike next week that would devastate the economy. Biden and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said that the lawmakers will be asked to vote today to impose the terms of the deals the 12 unions agreed to before an original strike deadline in September, even though four of those unions representing more than half of the 115,000 rail workers rejected them. Eight other unions ratified the five-year deals that included a 24% raise and $5,000 in bonuses. Congress, I think, has to act to prevent it, Biden says. It's not an easy call, but I think we have to do it. The economy is at risk. Unions and workers' groups have been pushing to improve the demanding schedules that they say make it hard for workers to ever take a day off and persuade railroads to add paid sick time. They have threatened to strike if new agreements can't be reached before a December 9th deadline. It's not enough to share workers' concerns, says the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees Division Unions said in a statement. A call to Congress to act immediately to pass legislation that adopts tentative agreements that exclude paid sick leave ignores the railroad workers' concerns. The union is one of the four that rejected their deal. The railroads that include BNSF, Union Pacific, CSX, Kansas City Southern, and Norfolk Southern have refused to consider adding sick time because they didn't want to spend any more on the labor deals than they agreed to in September. And in other news, in Bay City, Michigan, Biden touts labor unions. President Joe Biden reminded Americans he is a pro-union president on Tuesday as he toured a technology plant to highlight a $300 million expansion just a day before he sided with business leaders and asking Congress to pass legislation to stave off a crippling rail strike. The South Korean company SK Siltron is expected to quadruple its production in the coming years at that plant. It's the latest in a series of massive foreign investments in the U.S. manufacturing technology sectors trumpeted by Biden amid a push by his administration to onshore production of key components and products after the COVID-19 pandemic pushed long-simmering supply chain issues to the brink. Biden said that he's been pro-union his entire career and that the American workers were the best workers in the world. "You're the most qualified workers in the world," he goes on to say. "The middle class built America, and unions built the middle class," he says. Well, let's see. What else is going on here in Washington? Justices are holding a debate over Biden deportation policy. The Supreme Court on Tuesday wrestled with a politically tinged dispute over a Biden administration policy that would prioritize deportation of people in the country illegally who pose the greatest public safety risk. It was not clear after arguments that stretched past 2 hours and turned highly contentious at times whether the justices would allow the policy to take effect or side with Republican-led states that have so far succeeded in blocking it. At the center of the case is a September 2021 directive from the Department of Homeland Security that paused deportation unless individuals had committed acts of terrorism, espionage, or egregious threats to public safety. The guidance issued after Joe Biden became president updated a Trump-era policy that removed people in the country illegally regardless of criminal history or community ties. On Tuesday, the administration's top Supreme Court lawyer told the justices that federal law does not create an unyielding mandate to apprehend and remove every one of the more than 11 million immigrants living in the country illegally. Solicitor General Elizabeth Preloger said it would be incredibly destabilizing on the ground for the high court to require that. Congress has not given DHS enough money to vastly increase the number of people it holds and deports, the Biden administration has said. But Texas Solicitor General Judd Stone told the court that the administration is violating federal law that requires the detention and deportation of people who are in the U.S. illegally and who have been convicted of any serious crime, not just the most serious, specifically defined ones. Chief Justice John Roberts was among the conservative justices who pushed back strongly on the Biden administration's arguments. It's our job to say what the law is, not whether or not it can be possibly implemented or whether there are difficulties there. And I don't think we should change that responsibility just because Congress and the executive can't agree on something. I don't think we should let them off the hook, he says. Also in Washington, Oath Keepers found guilty of sedition. Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes was convicted on Tuesday of seditious conspiracy for a violent plot to overturn President Joe Biden's election, heading the Justice Department a major victory in its massive prosecution of the January 6, 2021 insurrection. A Washington, D.C. jury found Rhodes guilty of sedition after 3 days of deliberations. In the nearly two-month-long trial, it showcased the far-right extremist group's efforts to keep Republican Donald Trump in the White House at all costs. Rhodes was acquitted of two other conspiracy charges. One of Rhodes' co-defendants, Kelly Meigs, the leader of the Florida chapter of the Oath Keepers, was also convicted of the Sedition Act, while three other co-defendants were cleared of the charges. And juror found all five defendants guilty of obstruction of an official proceeding, Congress certification of Biden's electoral victory. Rhodes and Meigs are the first people in nearly three decades to be found guilty of the rarely used Civil War era charge at trial. The trial was the biggest test yet for the Justice Department in its efforts to hold accountable those responsible for attack that shook the foundations of American democracy. Seditious conspiracy calls for up to 20 years behind bars. Okay, now, let's take a look now at something else that I think we all probably are a little bit guilty of, nutrition. Few heed U.S. nutrition guides. A new study finds that few Americans have heard of MyPlate, the government diet guide that replaced the long-standing food pyramid. Remember that? Anyway, here's a quick quiz. What replaced the food pyramid, the government's guide to healthy eating, that stood for nearly 20 years? If you're stumped, well, you're not alone. More than a decade after Agriculture Department officials ditched the pyramid, few Americans have heard of MyPlate, a dinner plate-shaped logo that emphasizes fruits and vegetables. Only about 25% of adults were aware of MyPlate, and less than 10% had attempted to use the guidance, according to a study released on Tuesday by the National Center for Health Statistics. Those figures for 2017 through 2020 showed only slight improvements from a similar survey done just a few years earlier. That means that the Obama administration program that costs about $3 million a year hasn't reached most Americans, even as diet-related diseases such as obesity, diabetes, and heart disease have continued to rise. This is currently the primary educational tool that communicates guidelines for Americans, said the study's lead author, Edwina Wambogo, a nutrition epidemiologist at the agency. MyPlate should be doing a little bit better. The results are hardly surprising, said Marion Nestle, a food policy expert. Why would anyone expect otherwise, she said in an email. MyPlate never came with an education campaign. It's old hat by now. Only dealt with healthy foods, said nothing about unhealthy foods, and is so far from what Americans actually eat as to seem unattainable. A top USDA official said that the agency's proposed fiscal year 2023 budget seeks an increase from $3 million to $10 million a year to bolster the MyPlate campaign by extending its reach and making recipes and other materials more culturally relevant. We absolutely want to make sure that MyPlate and other critical tools are in the hands of more people, said Stacy Dean, Deputy Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services. The new study found that people who rated their diet as excellent, very good, or good were far more likely to have heard of MyPlate than those who said that their diet was fair or poor. Of those who heard of the plan, about one-third tried to follow it, the study finds. MyPlate was introduced in 2011 with high-profile support from former First Lady Michelle Obama, who made healthy eating and exercise her focus. It uses a dinner plate with four colored sections for fruit, vegetables, grain, and protein, with a smaller circle for dairy products such as low-fat milk or yogurt. It encouraged Americans to make half of their meals fruits and vegetables in what was promoted as a fast, easy, accessible format. But the guide left out crucial details, says Dr. Vijaya Sarampudi, a nutrition specialist at the University of California in L.A. It doesn't differentiate between starchy vegetables and non-starchy vegetables, she said. There's no fats on there. Nor does my plate acknowledge that vegetables, grains, and dairy foods also contain protein, Nestle went on to say. All right, now we're going to go all the way out there, way out in the Pacific to Hawaii. And you might be aware of what's going on there. They're having a huge volcano eruption, and it's drawing crowds. In Hilo, Hawaii, the first eruption in 38 years of the world's largest active volcano. It's attracting onlookers to a national park for spectacular views of the event. And it's also dredging up bad memories among some Hawaii residents who have been through harrowing volcanic experiences in the past. It was just 4 years ago that Nicole Skeeling fled her home near a community where more than 700 residences were destroyed by lava. She relocated to the South Kona area only to find herself packing her car with food and supplies this week after Momoloa erupted late Sunday. Officials were initially concerned that lava flowing down the side of the volcano would head towards South Kona, but scientists later assured the public that the eruption migrated to a rift zone in Mauna Loa's northeast flank and wasn't threatening any communities. It just happened last night, so I really haven't had a lot of time to worry about it yet, basically, Skilling said on Monday. And thankfully, right now, it's at the northeast rift zone. But if it breaks on the west side, that's when we're talking about coming into a large populated area. That's why I do have a little bit of PTSD. Even though there were no evacuation orders, some people decided to leave their homes, prompting officials to open shelters in the Kona and Kaua areas. Very few, if any, stayed in them overnight. Hawaii County Mayor Mitch Roth said, and they would be closing on Tuesday. Clearly, the danger for the Kaua area and Kona area has gone. So there's really no need to have the shelter up there any longer, Roth went on to say. Okay, let's take a look at another article here. U.S. bat species listed as endangered in Traverse City, Michigan. The Biden administration declared the northern long-eared bat endangered on Tuesday in a last-ditch effort to save a species driven to the brink of extinction by white-nose syndrome, a fungal disease. White-nose syndrome is decimating cave-dwelling bat species like the northern long-eared bat at unprecedented rates, said Martha Williams, director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The agency is deeply committed to working with partners on a balanced approach that reduces the impacts of diseases and protects the survivors to recover northern long-eared bat populations, she says. First documented in the U.S. in 2006, the disease has infected 12 types of bats and killed millions. The northern long-eared bats is among the hardest hit, with estimated declines of 97% or higher in affected populations. The bat is found in 37 eastern and north central states, plus Washington, D.C., as much of Canada. Named for white fuzzy spots that appear on infected bats, white-nose syndrome attacks bats' wings, muzzles, and ears when they hibernate in caves and abandoned mines. It causes them to wake early from hibernation and to sometimes fly outside. They can burn up their winter fat stores and eventually starve. The disease has spread across nearly 80% of the geographical range where northern long-eared bats live and is expected to cover it all by 2025. Another species ravaged by the fungus is the tricolored bat, which the government proposed to classify as endangered in September. A third, the little brown bat, is being evaluated for a potential listing. Bets are believed to give U.S. agriculture an annual boost of $3 billion by gobbling pests and pollinating some plants. The Fish and Wildlife Service designated the northern long-eared bat as threatened in 2015. With its situation increasingly dire, the agency proposed an endangered listing in March and considered public comments before deciding to proceed. The reclassification takes effect January 30th, 2023. And that does it for today for the reading of the Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, the 20th of November. I am your announcer, Peter Welch, and you've been listening to IRIS, which is Iowa Radio Information Services Reading Network for the Blind and the Disabled. Thank you so much for listening. Bundle up. It's cold out there today. Take care. Bye-bye.